Iran will not interfere in the election and will support any candidate whom the Lebanese agree on. The Lebanese must decide among themselves on the issue of electing a president for their republic. It is a purely an internal Lebanese affair.
Amir Abdullahian's trip to Lebanon also included a meeting with his Lebanese counterpart Abdullah Bouhabib, where they discussed a number of issues, the most important of which were the impact of the Iran-Saudi agreement on the region, as well as the current situation in Lebanon. The Iranian minister also proposed new ideas to assist Lebanon in resolving its crises during his talks with the country's officials, reiterating Iran's readiness to provide Lebanon with fuel and cooperate with the country to ease its electricity crisis. Experts have hailed the visit, noting that it could have positive impacts on the political situation in Lebanon.
Such visits by a regional state as Iran are natural visits, especially to a country like Lebanon, which has regional implications in its internal politics. This visit also comes to enlighten the allies and the Lebanese officials on the latest concerning the regional changes after the Beijing meetings, how this reflects on Lebanon. But Iran can also help in providing a ripe ground for a political agreement in Lebanon on the presidential election.
During his visit, the Iranian minister also met with the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah. Amir Abdullahian and Nasrallah discussed the latest regional developments, as well as the developments in Palestine, and the role the resistance plays in shaping the future of the region.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and Lebanese officials reviewed the latest developments in the region and discussed the various challenges and crises facing the Lebanese government. During meetings, both Iranian and Lebanese sides unanimously agreed that any solution to such challenges should come from inside the country, based on Lebanese requirements and will. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
On a normal day, they'd be in classrooms doing what they do best. But today, these teachers say, is time for action. After the nationwide February strikes, the government made a new pay offer to the teachers, which included a one-off payment of more than $1,200 this year and a 4.3% pay rise for most staff next year against a teacher's demand for a 9% rise. To the Minister of Education, Gillian Keegan, that was a fair and reasonable offer. To the teachers, who have seen a relative decline in their pay since 2010, it was an outrage.
Because we've had a pay freeze for loads of successive years since 2010, and then a few pay awards that were either below or in line with inflation, that's effectively another pay cut.
The government claims the rises will be covered by extra funding provided to state schools over the next 2 years.
The unions representing the teachers say this is not just about pay. As with other public sector disputes, they say it's about a lack of investment. It's about cuts to funding for schools, about teacher shortages.
Special education needs teacher Fiona Edwards recently told a special committee that gives recommendation to the government on teacher pay rises about how a lack of funding is impacting teacher recruitment.
I have 31 children with education, health and care plans, again, quite a bit above the national average. 11 of these children are in our autism unit. The autism unit ought to have 14 children, but at the moment we've only got 4 members of staff, not 5. We've been trying for a year to recruit a 5th member of staff, and until we do so, we can't have any more children in the unit.
The UK has been gripped by waves of public sector industrial action for months, brought on by double-digit inflation and a cost-of-living crisis. Despite the inconvenience caused by the strikes, public support for them remains strong.
I support it. I think the government should get back round the table and offer a decent pay increase so they can get back to work.
I think it's not surprising and absolutely inevitable, and I fully support the teachers.
And while the government twiddles its thumbs, there will be another strike on May the 2nd, once again keeping hundreds of thousands of teachers and students out of the classrooms. Saeed Purizza, London.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the White House in Washington for a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden. The two celebrated the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and discussed responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile development, to which the U.S. leader issued a warning.
Nuclear attack by North Korea against the United States or its allies or partisans our partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime were to take such an action.
President Yoon has sought to strengthen the alliance with the U.S. to include a stronger commitment to extended deterrence, the U.S. so-called nuclear umbrella, and the regular deployment of U.S. strategic assets, weapons which can deliver a nuclear strike.
Sustainable peace on the Korean Peninsula does not happen automatically. Our two leaders have decided to significantly strengthen extended deterrence of our two countries against North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, so we can achieve peace through the overwhelming superiority of our forces and not a false peace.
Under the new policy, U.S. nuclear submarines will make port calls in South Korea for the first time in 40 years. New U.S.-South Korea military activities were outlined in the summit communique, the Washington Declaration. It describes the formation of a nuclear consultative group for the U.S. and South Korea to better coordinate responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile developments. Meanwhile, peace activist leaders rallied in front of the presidential office in Seoul. They contend such aggressive U.S.-South Korea policies and resumed large-scale joint military drills only increase tension.
Only dialogue and negotiation can generate peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean and U.S. authorities should immediately stop deploying strategic assets and practicing war and abolish expansionary deterrence policies. We must engage in dialogue with North Korea without conditions.
With Washington's blessing, President Yoon has also moved to participate in a trilateral alliance with Japan and the U.S., despite widespread public opposition. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In spite of the government's ongoing legal battle with the Supreme Court over elections, 180 lawmakers gave Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif their full confidence in his ability to lead the country, granting him a vote of confidence from the National Assembly.
The National Assembly of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan reposes its full confidence in the leadership of Mian Muhammad Shehbaz Sharif as the Prime Minister of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan.
Sharif praised his party members and allies for their support after being elected last year with 174 votes to succeed Imran Khan, who was ousted in a vote of no confidence.
Parliament ne mujhe jo vote of confidence diya hai.
This parliament elected me as the Prime Minister. If this parliament reaches a decision after debate and obliges the government and cabinet, then it is mandatory for me to respect its decision. The judiciary does not have the right to rewrite the constitution. This is a violation of the law and the constitution.
The former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan, who has been attempting to force early elections, has suffered a major setback as a result of the governing coalition's show of power. Khan dissolved his party's local governments of the Punjab and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in January in an effort to press the government for holding early elections. However, the ruling coalition turned down his demands despite intervention by the country's top court, arguing that the government is unable to hold elections in May due to shortage of financial resources and the country's deteriorating security situation. Khan's political party, PTI, believes that government is afraid of its possible defeat in the upcoming elections, and that's why it is using delaying tactics.
We want to get the country out of this chaotic situation through holding fresh elections. Our mission is to find a solution through these discussions, and we believe that whatever solution we propose will be in accordance with the constitution.
Meanwhile, following the directives given by the top court, both the government and the opposition started negotiations to set a time frame for holding fresh polls in the country. Although the talks between the government and the opposition have been initiated on the directives of the country's top court, analysts say it is unlikely that these negotiations will yield any positive result, as the ruling coalition seems determined to complete its constitutional term, which will be ended in August this year. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
A loss that can be never replaced. At the age of 69, Nader Talibzadeh succumbed to his heart disease at a hospital in the Iranian capital. Now, a year after he was laid to rest, the veteran Iranian movie producer, director, and researcher is revered as a champion and, in the words of leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, a revolutionary researcher and artist.
Talibzadeh believed that the Islamic Revolution is a light that should shine on the whole world. He believed that it is our job to spread the message of the Islamic Revolution. That is why he made so many documentaries.
It is with this mentality that Nader Talibzadeh founded the Ammar International Popular Film Festival in 2010. Talibzadeh's death has been widely grieved in Iran and across the region, where he was known as the face of resistance media.
The legacy of Nader Talibzadeh was, if I want to put it in like two or three words, to be the voice of the voiceless, to always support the oppressed people all around the globe, not in this country, not only in the countries in this region, but everywhere in the world. If you've seen his documentaries, if you've seen his programs on Press TV, on the other channels, and also on YouTube, he started a show on YouTube called Nader's Show. He spoke about everything in every part of the world. So his legacy is to always call for justice, to be the voice of the voiceless, and hopefully we will continue this path and we will hold on to his legacy.
During his fruitful career, Nader Talibzadeh directed, wrote, and produced numerous award-winning documentary films. Following a decade of research in historical documents based on the Holy Quran and the Bible, in 2007, he produced his first feature-length movie titled The Messiah. In this movie, he presented an Islamic perspective on Jesus and his teachings.
He was there whenever he was needed. His TV shows were aimed at raising public awareness, and in short, he was the voice of the Islamic Revolution.
His interviews with foreign guests on his TV shows were very educational. He used media to shed light on the unknown. He was a great teacher.
Most importantly, Talibzadeh served as the chairman of the International New Horizon Conference, an annual event that scrutinizes the hegemonic policies and war crimes of the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Together with his wife Zainab Mahana, they were blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington for organizing the conference.
The veteran Iranian journalist, TV producer, show host, documentary filmmaker, and director Nader Talibzadeh passed away a year ago, but his memory lives on, and he will always be remembered as one of the most influential cultural figures in Iran. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Embassy of Iran in Russia hosted a reception on the occasion of the Day of the Army of the Islamic Republic. A number of guests congratulated the representatives of Iran on the achievements in the industrial and defense sectors.
While some states bend to the diktats of the United States, Iran boldly acts as it sees fit. Iran has had significant military achievements. The areas of military technical cooperation have shown that Russia takes a lot from Iran, but it also means that Russia gives a lot to Iran. In the near future, the Iranian army will be much stronger in terms of combat aircraft, anti-aircraft systems, and other things. In addition, new opportunities have been brought forth regarding cooperation between Russia, Iran, and China.
Russian-Iranian relations have taken a new direction as the two countries are under similar Western pressure, which necessitates more cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Recent quadripartite meeting of defense ministers of Iran, Syria, Russia, and Turkey in Moscow shows that cooperation is not limited to the military field, but it also covers other areas.
The trilateral cooperation between the three countries is very important for the stability in the region as well as in the whole world. We need to strengthen this cooperation because there is a kind of complementarity of interest between the three countries' policies. This is why each one of us need the two others. And we are not just friends, we became strong allies. So alliance means that you should take into consideration the interest of others. And this is exactly what's happening between the three of us.
In his speech, the representative of the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation noted that military cooperation between Russia and Iran is a fundamental element in the bilateral relations and is of a strategic nature.
The Army Day is celebrated in Moscow on a high level. Iranian embassy has organized a reception in honor of this day for many reasons. Now that Russian-Iranian military cooperation has reached a new grade, the reception is attended by important guests, ambassadors, politicians and military attaches. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. French President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday, 25th of April, steered clear from close contact with the public as he made a new foray into provincial France in the wake of his signing of a hugely unpopular pension reform law. We take a look at the French media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. France's national broadcaster, France 24 or France 24, has covered this story and tells us more. President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday, 25th of April, steered well clear from close contact with the public as he made a new foray into provincial France in the wake of his signing of a hugely unpopular pension reform law. A visit Macron made to eastern France last Wednesday, 26th of April, was marked by acrimonious face-to-face confrontations between the head of the state and some inhabitants unhappy over the raise in the retirement age in France to 64 from 62, and President Macron's style of governance. Just over 1 year since he won his second mandate in office, his trip to the Loire region of central France saw no similar walkabout to meet area residents. Hundreds of people had turned up, banging saucepans, a traditional symbol of political protest in France, but President Macron was instead whisked away into the health centre in the town of Vendôme that he was visiting. "It is to wake up our president so that he stops making fun of us," said Bruno Vivienne, a retired metallurgy worker who made his protest heard with a bugle. They made their dissatisfaction known by banging pots and booing within audible distance of the president, who at the end of his visit was flown back to Paris by helicopter. The local authority had banned any protests around the area where President Macron was visiting, but a court in the nearby city of Orléans overturned this ruling after complaints from human rights groups. With his popularity plunging after the signing of the pension reform, President Macron has set a 100-day target to relaunch his second mandate, with Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne due to announce plans next Wednesday. "We must look at the heart of the subject and the life of our compatriots and not the adornments," said Macron, who during the trip made no major announcement on the health sector. The tensions are being felt throughout Emmanuel Macron's government, with Education Minister Papnadiaye's visit to Lyon on Monday disrupted when protesters stormed an institute he was due to visit. The Education Minister later angrily denounced posts on Twitter giving the time of his return train to Paris and telling people to rally at the train station in Paris. A photo of the target meeting time in a train station This is an incitement to violence, he wrote on Twitter. The presence of hundreds of protesters at Gare de Lyon station in Paris meant that Education Minister Papnédiaye was delayed from disembarking from his TGV train and had to be escorted out by a side door. Meanwhile, after protesters were filmed burning an effigy of Emmanuel Macron in the southeastern city of Grenoble, prosecutors said they had opened an investigation into showing contempt for a person holding public authority. President Macron, a 45-year-old, admitted over the weekend that he may not have been physically present enough in the campaign to pass the pension reform, which only went through Parliament after the government used a mechanism to bypass a vote by French MPs. Perhaps the mistake was not being sufficiently present, Emmanuel Macron said in Le Parisien newspaper. A war of attrition aimed at the president and his government looks to have no sign of letting up, with pots and pans the weapon of choice. President Macron's first trip to a French region since signing his unpopular pension reform didn't go down well. The photos and videos taken on Wednesday, 19th of April, bear witness to the flop. Crowds of protesters booed as he stepped foot in the small town of Célestat in eastern France's Alsace region, banging pots and pans and chanting, "Macron resign." It was time to take new photographs, tell a new story. That of a population who appreciates their president and who are in favour of the pension reform, or at the very least, who understand the need to raise the legal retirement age in France from 62 to 64. So Emmanuel Macron did what he deemed was necessary. The following day, President Macron made his way to Ganges in southern France. But before his arrival, the president ordered police to keep protesters away from the school he would be visiting. A decree banning the use of portable sounding devices was also issued by the local authorities to avoid any unwanted background noise. In other words, no pots and pans were allowed. In the 3 months after announcing the deeply unpopular pension reform, President Emmanuel Macron made very few public appearances to speak to French voters. These trips outside of Paris are a way for him to signal his willingness to turn the page and show that he's not hiding from French voters, many of whom are outraged by the way the legislation has been passed. French newspaper Le Monde has also covered this story and tells us more. The cat-and-mouse game between protesters and the government continued as French politicians tried in vain to dodge the noisy pots and pans throughout France's streets. A few hours before the French Cup final, on Saturday, 29th of April, the government likely dreaded the 30,000 red cards and 10,000 whistles distributed by the trade unions to football fans in anticipation of the French President Emmanuel Macron's visit to the Stade de France. In addition, some 300 Labour Day demonstrations are expected to take place throughout the country in just 2 days on Monday, 1st of May. The government's appeasement mantra has not borne fruit, and the President has opted to proceed with public appearances and a competition of who can be the loudest. Nothing could be worse than letting progressive voices be drowned out by the cries of demagogues, Emmanuel Macron wrote in a letter to his supporters. During Wednesday's Council of Ministers, he summoned his cabinet to have the courage to say what Macron supporters have the courage to do. Over the past 10 days, about 30 ministerial visits have been disrupted, and several ministers and state secretaries have cancelled their trips, including Charlotte Corbel, the childhood minister, on Monday in Val-de-Marne, in Greater Paris region, Beranger Cuillard, Environment Minister, on Tuesday in Charente-Maritime, southwestern France, and Sébastien Lecornu, Minister of the Armed Forces, on Thursday in Loire-Atlantique, northwestern France, among others. "We're not fleeing," someone close to Stanislas Guérini, Public Service Minister, said after his visit to Castelnau-le-Lez in southern France, where CGT activists equipped with pots and pans were waiting for him, and he was diverted to La Grande Motte, some 24 kilometres away by car. No minister or state secretary, however little known, has been spared. Absent from the press and reticent to carry a law that would have to defend before the Assemblée Nationale, the education minister, Pape Ndiaye, nonetheless faced protest in Lyon on Tuesday and then was blocked for a long time in his train in Paris, where demonstrators waited for him and he had to be ushered away by police. Similarly, Marc Fesneau, agriculture minister, who said he was pleased with his low UBM or media noise unit score, also came up against pots and pans in Rouen on Thursday. The French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, has asked ministers to postpone non-essential trips and offered one piece of advice to them: be smart. Smart like the Élysée, which has chosen to keep certain presidential visits secret. Filmed by a small group of journalists flown in by helicopter from Paris, President Emmanuel Macron could be seen on Thursday within range of shouting, but still well away from protesters wielding pots and pans, to which police had barred access. In one exchange taking place in a market, Emmanuel Macron said, "You're talking nonsense," to a yellow vest Gilets Jaunes protester, who replied, "You've been talking nonsense every day for the past 5 years." Macron's visits to various communities around France are now divided into two distinct atmospheres, indoors and outdoors. Like a candidate on the campaign trail, he takes the stage, expounding on his themes, defending his record, ready to take questions. But outside the venue for that day's visit is a totally different story.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Prabhat Athwaite. The U.S. is continuing its militaristic approach towards nuclear-armed North Korea. In the latest offensive, U.S. President Joe Biden and his South Korean counterpart said Pyongyang would face the end of its leadership if it uses its nuclear arsenal. Why is the U.S. provoking North Korea, who has been on a rapid pace when it comes to developing nuclear weapons? China has reacted, warning Washington and Seoul against provoking confrontation with North Korea. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S., in addition to China, is facing another standoff, namely with North Korea. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Ken Hamon, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, joins us from New Mexico. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at the International Schiller Institute, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany. I'd like to welcome you both, and I'll first start with you, Ken Hamon, if I may. The President, Joe Biden, couldn't be clearer in terms of what he said. And let me quote him. "Look, a nuclear attack by North Korea against the U.S. or its allies or partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime to take such an action." It kind of reminds us of the "we'll be met with fire and fury," or whatever that was that the U.S. President, former U.S. President Donald Trump said. Which one do you think is worse? Are they sending the same message?
Oh, I think they're definitely sending the same message. It's just a question of the selection of rhetoric. This kind of threat to North Korea, of course, you know, the only reason that North Korea is investing its resources in its own nuclear program is to defend itself against the threat that the United States has constituted towards it for 50 plus years now, 60 plus years now, since the end of the war on the peninsula. You know, North Korea is in a very defensive position, and these latest actions by President Biden and as you mentioned, President Trump before him, simply ratchet up the tensions and are part of, you know, America's aggressive stance trying to maintain its position in East Asia.
Yeah, and when you think that the tension is going to be higher, they keep increasing, Harley Schlanger. I mean, basically, Washington and Seoul have secured this deal, which is called the Nuclear Pact, from what we understand, which is the way it's been described, a periodic deployment of U.S. nuclear submarines to South Korea. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Harley Schlanger, but the U.S. has said that it will not subscribe to having nuclear arms in the peninsula, especially in South Korea. But doesn't this constitute that, be it intermittently?
Well, I don't think you can go by anything that President Biden is saying. I agree with the other guest that what we're seeing is a reckless ratcheting up of tensions coming from Washington. And I would urge the people of South Korea to take a look at what Washington and NATO are doing to Ukraine by bringing the Ukrainians into the war that they're trying to wage against Russia. It's destroying that country. The idea that Biden is preparing for a nuclear response to North Korea, you know, this is at the same time that the Biden administration is accusing Putin of threatening to use nuclear weapons, which Putin is not doing. So you add to this that this represents an extension of NATO to the Pacific, the so-called global NATO, which includes the Australian, UK, US nuclear submarine deal. Now the South Koreans, the Japanese are being brought in, rearming Japan. This is all insane. It's based on a U.S. reaction against the fact that China has become a successful economic nation, and that's why it's being viewed as a threat. And I bring up this question of what's happening to Ukraine because while the U.S. is saying we're doing this for Ukrainian freedom and democracy, what's happening is they're killing off the people of Ukraine for the purposes of a NATO attempt to weaken or break up Russia. So the people of South Korea would be very wise to look at what's happening in Europe on the other side of the globe and realize having a promise from the United States such as this only means there's a likelihood of a war, which will be a catastrophe for the people of South Korea and of North Korea.
Okay, when our guest there, Ken Hammond, talks about how South Koreans should react to this and take a lesson from what's happening to Ukraine, it makes it sound like South Korea perhaps has sovereignty when it comes to its military doctrine. But correct me if I'm wrong, based on some of the research done here, the South Korea, in particular its military, does not really have a say when it comes to the way that it can react in its foreign policy arena unless the U.S. directs it or approves it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's exactly correct. The provisions of the relationship between the United States and the military in South Korea are that even in ordinary times, there's a tremendous amount of coordination. A lot of South Korean military personnel are rotated through assignments with American units so that they train together and their functioning is largely integrated. In the event that any kind of hostilities should occur, the command of the South Korean Army reverts to the United States. So in essence, the South Korean Army becomes simply an extension of American military power in the southern part of the peninsula. So the idea that the South Korean military is in some way, you know, might be a counterbalance or something like that to American recklessness, I'm afraid is not that's not going to work very well. But I do agree that the, you know, the people of South Korea need to be very cautious about what their government is doing, and perhaps rethink the power that they have invested in Mr. Yoon. Because he is obviously aligning himself quite closely with American interests, which are not necessarily at all the same as those of the South Korean people.
Yeah, and when you take a look, Harley Steinger, at the U.S., in particular, obviously, Joe Biden, have you detected any statements, any motions, or anything that's even rings any kind of diplomacy when it comes to North Korea? I mean, not even an ounce at this point, going on to almost 4 years now in his presidency. Why do you think he has not even made any effort to pursue down that path, just in statements, maybe not making a commitment, but just invoke some kind of a diplomatic overture to North Korea?
Well, I think that's characteristic of his overall policy. Whatever else Biden is, he is a puppet for the interests that are committed to maintaining the United States as the world hegemon, the unipolar order, what Blinken calls the rules-based order, which means the U.S. determines the rules. And countries like South Korea, Japan, Australia become subordinate to U.S. interests. But the idea is that the U.S. is trying to fight these wars with other people's armies. Now, in that context, when you talk about Biden and diplomacy, where's the diplomacy that could have avoided the war in Ukraine? He rejected it. So did NATO. Now the same thing is going on toward China and North Korea. Say what you will about Donald Trump, but he did try to talk to the North Koreans, and there was a brief moment before he unleashed the lunatic John Bolton. There was a brief moment where there was conversation going on with North Korea. There's none of that that we've seen from Biden, including back channels. There was a talk of a back channel, which never, as far as I know, never really was activated.
Well, taking a look at what the South Korean president has said, Ken Hammond, it's interesting. He said, Seoul will respond firmly to North Korean provocations, but will keep the door open for dialogue on North Korean denuclearization. This kind of sounds like it's dictating the way that were there to be any talks, North Korea should behave, which is the same error in the approach that the U.S. has made when it comes to North Korea. Why are they not open to negotiations when we're talking about North Korea's firing of these missiles, which has been ramped up in the past year, especially in the past 6 months?
Well, I think that North Korea's missile tests and whatever other military developments they're pursuing, as we've said before, you know, these are their defensive measures. You know, North Korea is threatened. You know, we have American troops in the southern part of the peninsula, where the ROK troops are there. You know, now the United States is talking about having nuclear submarines with atomic weapons on them, making port calls in South Korea. North Korea's obviously, you know, got to do something to try to keep the United States and its you know, its projection there in South Korea from simply trying to get rid of it, trying to destroy it. That's the long-term objective, of course, is to get rid of the North Korean regime, get rid of the North Korean government, get rid of the North Korean state. So I think that you know, when the South Korean president, you know, makes a gesture of sort of saying, well, you know, we'll go along with the United States, but we also want to, you know, leave the door open for possible talks about denuclearization, and then agrees to having these port calls by American nuclear armed submarines. You know, the contradiction there, it's just barefaced. I mean, it's just the way that they say one thing and do another thing. We see this in American, you know, political rhetoric and political actions a lot, that there's this sometimes verbal commitment to certain principles, and then the government acts in ways that are diametrically opposed to those. So I think that the reluctance to even you know, broach the idea of negotiation of an engagement with the other side just reflects the depth of the anxiety, the depth of the fear that American political elites have of losing their dominant hegemonic position. And I think that you know, they fear, you know, I suppose, starting down some slippery slope that's going to result in a further deterioration of their power. But I think that, you know, it's a very dangerous attitude and posture to maintain.
Well, Harley Steinger, you talked about the former U.S. President Donald Trump
And he said, whatever you think about him, at least he made an effort to speak to the North Korean leader, and that was a positive sign. But when it came down to it, wasn't there also at least openness, maybe, when it came to any type of sanction relief for North Korea, which appears to be one of the things that North Korea is not getting from the U.S.? I think if we want to take a look at that, that is something that perhaps is an impediment. It's stopping any type of perhaps cooling down of North Korea and being more open towards any diplomatic and negotiated type of settlement for this.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. There's a complete hypocrisy. And I wasn't defending Trump. I was just pointing out that he at least had a discussion process. But you're absolutely right. If you want to have rapprochement with a country, you don't start by sending nuclear submarines in their backyard and talking about the willingness to use nuclear weapons to defend your ally in South Korea. The negotiations start by looking at what's the big problem there. North Korea has an economic crisis. It's had it for a long time because of its isolation. You don't solve that problem by making them more isolated, by rattling sabers at them and talking about deliberate action to ensure the protection of South Korea, which wouldn't need to be protected if there was a true rapprochement. I think the hypocrisy of the U.S. policy is now seen by virtually everyone. I'm surprised the South Koreans have been blind to it. You know, not so surprised about the Japanese because they have a whole history of this. And the Australians, well, they're part of the Five Eyes. But most of the rest of the world is moving away from this kind of U.S. hegemon, unipolar order idea where the U.S. makes the rules and everyone else has to submit to them or be targeted for military action. So I think what Biden, you know, Trump, whatever he intended to do, he failed. Biden is not even willing to make a gesture. And I think that speaks very poorly for not just Biden, but the people around him, such as Blinken and Sullivan and Victoria Nuland and the old Clinton-Obama crowd like Susan Rice. All of them are part of the Democratic Party War Hawk faction. And that's not a solution to these kinds of problems.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Ken Hammond, let's just say by some miracle, by something that perhaps the U.S. may do, North Korea is willing to think about getting into some kind of negotiations with the U.S. But when it thinks about getting into that diplomatic arena, there's a precedent that has been set here in the Islamic Republic. We're very well aware of what happens when you get into an agreement with the U.S. on a nuclear-related issue. All they have to do is take a look at that and say, why should we get into an agreement with the U.S. when this is what they have done? Doesn't that serve as a warning sign for North Korea, were there to ever be a channel opened up that way?
Well, I think the North Koreans have their own experience with that as well. Back in the second Bush administration, there were actually some overtures. North Korea stepped away from some of its research, some of its nuclear development, and there was a program to sort of move forward with negotiations and with providing assistance to for energy development and things like that. And the United States subsequently completely abrogated that, walked away from that, just dropped it like a hot rock. And so I don't know why the North Koreans, you know, would have a lot of faith or trust in American diplomacy. It's been shown to be hypocritical, not just in the relationship with North Korea, but many times in the past. So, you know, the dilemma, of course, is that North Korea would like to be able to, you know, devote its resources to its own economic development, to improving the livelihoods of its people. But it is under constant, relentless pressure and threat from the South, from the United States, which you know, requires it to maintain this military development. And, you know, it's as a long-term strategy, of course, we've seen the United States use arms races in the past to wreak havoc with the Soviet Union. So, you know, this idea of kind of just keeping the pressure on relentlessly and constantly provoking the North, it's designed eventually to bring about some kind of breakdown or some sort of systemic change. So I think that North Korea is entirely reasonable in learning from their experience and learning from the experience, as you mentioned, of the nuclear discussions with the Islamic Republic. And, you know, the United States just does nothing but pursue its own self-interest or the self-interest of its ruling classes. And, you know, North Korea has to make the best path that it can in navigating that situation.
All right, let's talk about China a little bit here, Harley Schlanger. And first of all, China has said all parties should face up to the crux of the Korean Peninsula issue and play a constructive role in promoting peaceful settlement of the issue. What's very interesting about China in terms of what the U.S. Has said regarding North Korea and also what the U.S. has asked Russia is that it has said both Russia and China should play a role in using their influence on North Korea for it to stop firing these projectiles. Why would China even entertain that thought when the U.S. is after China offensively, militarily? And I'm not going to say, of course, how the U.S. has been after Russia and the way that Russia has responded to this and China.
Well, the Russians and the Chinese know something about the intention of the ruling establishment in the United States. It's not to establish zones of peace and economic development. Everywhere the United States goes, as at the same with the situation before that with the British Empire, people are left impoverished. The idea of the United States is not to have economic development in these countries. If we wanted to, we could do that. And you're absolutely right, starting with ending the sanctions. Sanctions, in my opinion, are war crimes because they, you know, the more people have been killed in some of these countries like Iraq by sanctions than by the actual war. And on this point you were making about the Islamic Republic and the U.S. treatment of Iran, look at Libya. Libya also ended their weapons of mass destruction program, and look what the U.S. did to Gaddafi. So there's no reason for North Korea to have trust and confidence in the United States. And now we're hearing the same thing from Putin. What Putin has said is there's no one to work with in the West. There's no one we can trust because of the level of betrayal. But that's the question of intent. And I think it's really important to understand that the leaders of the United States and both parties, the leaders of most of the political or the governments in Europe, have an intent to maintain the limited sovereignty of nations outside of their own circle. And that's something which is changing now. Countries are demanding the right to have economic development, an end to the colonial and neocolonial system. And the U.S. just keeps doubling down on insisting that we in the United States can make the rules and everyone else has to obey, or we have NATO or global NATO to enforce those rules. And that's not a winning proposition.
Curious to know whether the countries in that region, Ken Hammond, are on board when it comes to what the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, for example, are doing when it comes to North Korea. I mean, surely these countries don't want any type of military confrontation to happen here, especially when you're talking about a nuclear one, potentially. I'm sure they're not all on board when it comes to the U.S. move towards North Korea. Or are they? Or how do you feel the situation is like there?
Well, I think you know there's a range of variation across the region. some of the governments, and we have to be clear that these are decisions that are being made by governments in power in different countries. Some of the governments, Japan and at the present time South Korea, are aligning themselves closely with the United States. There have been large demonstrations in South Korea, also some demonstrations in Japan, expressions of protest against that alignment, against these new policies, against the rearmament in Japan. I'm sure that there will be concern expressed by many people in South Korea about these nuclear-armed submarine visits that are on the agenda now. I think if you look elsewhere around the region, you can see countries that are very anxious about the American role. Even a country like the Philippines, where they're having base agreements with the United States again, but there's considerable unease about American conduct. And when you get down certainly into Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, even Malaysia, Indonesia, these countries are very cautious in their attitude towards the United States. They don't want to totally alienate the United States. They don't want the United States to start seeing them as enemies, because that's a very dangerous proposition. But they're very clearly expressing their desire to find, maybe a middle path, a way not to be aligned so closely with the United States, because they recognize that really the future in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and much of the world is the future of China's developing economy, China's developing, new society, and that the United States is trying desperately to hold on to a declining preeminence in the world, and that's a losing proposition, and I think countries are frightened by what the United States may do to try to protect that, and I think many countries are, and certainly many people, are very anxious about the state of play.
Okay, final question, Harley Chang, in under a minute. So you have a checklist from the U.S. Military exercises with regional allies, check. Now you have a nuclear armed submarine, check. You have sanctions, check. What other things in the toolbox does the U.S. have that it may exercise that may cross that red line for North Korea?
Well, I'm not sure what would cross a red line for North Korea. The real issue here is that there is an opportunity for peace. This is the approach that the Chinese have been taking. This is what the G20 outside of the Western countries, the G20 is looking for a change in this. From the U.S. side, the only thing that I see that would change it is the fact that the U.S. can't afford a two-front war. And I mean, they can't afford it militarily or financially. And at some point, you're going to have to pay the piper. And, I think it's more likely that the U.S. will cross its own internal red line. And hopefully some people in the U.S. will come to their senses and back away from this kind of confrontation.
Thank you very much, Harley Sanger, spokesman, International Schiller.